1961, 40 men answered an advertisement in a local newspaper to take part in an experiment on memory at Yale University in America. The psychologist in charge, Stanley Milgram, told the volunteers he wanted to see how human memory worked. Each man was taken to a room where they met another volunteer, and this other volunteer was strapped up to a device which was called a shock generator. So each man seen this other volunteer being strapped to the shock generator and having electrodes attached to their arm. And then a screen was brought across so that they couldn't see this other volunteer. And a psychologist said, "I'll stay in the room and I'll explain to you how this experiment works. I'm going to give you instructions and I want you to follow them to the letter." So the volunteers, who were being paid $4.50 for their time, sat down, and they were told that what they were doing was they were going to see how pain affects how we remember things. You know, could we use pain, could we use punishment to increase memory, or does it decrease memory? And so these men thought this was fine. This is Yale University, this is a trained psychologist, we'll continue with the experiment. The shock generator in front of them had a dial which they had to turn, and they would press a button, and every time the man on the other side of the screen, who they couldn't see, remember, every time this other man made a mistake, they would press the button and give him a jolt, give him a shock. And the dial would go up in 15 volt increments, so, you know, 15 volts, 45 volts, 75 volts, they were applying shocks then, and the man on the other side would give a quiet grunt, but he really didn't express any real discomfort till he got to 75 volts. By the time the volunteers were applying volts of around 150 volts, the man on the other side of the screen would begin to plead and say to the psychologist, "Please, you know, get me out of here. I don't want to continue this experiment anymore. Let me go." And the psychologist would turn calmly to the volunteer, the man who had answered the newspaper advertisement, and say, "Continue. Carry on, please." Of the 40 men who answered that newspaper advertisement, 26 were prepared to administer volts of around 400, which were marked XXX on the shock generator, clearly marked as enough to kill a man, extremely dangerous. And the men who answered the newspaper advertisement would plead with the man conducting the experiment, who they believed was a psychologist, and said, "Look, we need to stop this. This isn't right." And you can go on YouTube and see these videos. These men are extremely uncomfortable, yet they continued with the experiment. Of course, it was a setup. The shock generator wasn't a shock generator at all. The man on the other side of the screen who could not be seen was an actor, as was the man who they believed to be a psychologist. And this experiment shocked America when Stanley Milgram wrote a book on it in 1974, because this experiment was meant to demonstrate to the American public how far the ordinary citizen will go just to obey orders. That the ordinary American citizen will inflict terrible pain and suffering on his neighbour just to obey orders. And that was very important in the 70s, because that's when the Holocaust really began to come into public consciousness, and people began to become aware that during the Second World War, ordinary Germans had done terrible things to their Jewish neighbours. And people were beginning to ask why. And yes, there are lessons there to learn about human nature, but one thing that people conveniently forget is this. That the men who answered the newspaper advertisement believed that the man who was telling them to increase the volts and to increase the suffering of the person on the other side of the screen, they believed this man to be a scientist. They were at Yale University. They were in an official scientific-looking room with official scientific-looking equipment. And these men would conduct these experiments under the authority of science. They believed that what they were doing was right because a scientist was in control. We mentioned last Sunday that science is a great and wonderful thing. Science gives us tremendous freedom. It allows us to travel around the globe. It's given us combustion engines and jet engines. Science has given us all sorts of medical treatments for many, many diseases that years ago would have killed us. I dare say there's plenty of people in this room who would not be here today if it was not for medical science. Yet I imagine that their treatments may very well cause them very little inconvenience at all. Science is a great and a wonderful thing, but just like friendship, just like love, just like romance, like anything, it can become an idol. And when it becomes an idol, it becomes dangerous. When anything becomes an idol, it becomes dangerous. What we mentioned Sunday past was that many people today, many people in your schools will be putting the idea to you that we don't need God anymore because we have science. Science can explain anything. Science can explain everything. As a matter of fact, science is so good at explaining things that science is the only thing we should listen to. And some people have mentioned that people in their classes are bringing forward the Big Bang and saying, look, the Big Bang theory explains why the universe exists. The Big Bang theory explains why things are the way they are. As a matter of fact, we pointed out that that isn't the case. If you want to take the Big Bang theory seriously, you have to seriously consider the possibility that this is strong evidence for God's existence. The Big Bang says the universe began to exist. And it began to exist, you know, before it there was nothing. All of a sudden, from an infinitely small point, everything expanded. The universe had a beginning. Things don't begin to exist without a reason, without an explanation. The only explanation we have is something outside of this universe that has to be God. So if your friends believe in the Big Bang, they've got to take that very, very seriously. They have to think about that argument and say, well, does the Big Bang get rid of God? Well, no, it doesn't. But what will quite often be said back in those conversations is, well, okay, let's say that the Big Bang does show that the universe began to exist. Well, maybe science will come up with an explanation for that. You know, you're bringing God in early. Maybe science will come up with another explanation. Science can explain everything. In your science classes at the minute, you're probably doing all sorts of interesting things, like attaching weights to springs and measuring the length of the spring after you've attached a weight to it, and measuring proportions, doing all sorts of experiments, you know, heating chemicals and seeing what temperature they boil at. The reason you're doing this is because science explains the world in terms of laws. You get laws that describe how gases behave. You get laws that describe how molecules behave and how atoms behave. You get laws that describe what happens with energy. And basically, science, that's what science is at. It's trying to describe the universe, trying to describe everything that you see in terms of laws. What's going on out there? What are the laws that govern our world? Well, what if one day scientists come up with a list of laws that explain everything? I mean, that's what they're aiming at, the whole shebang. Well, has science explained the universe then? Have they explained away God? Not for one second. Not for one second. Because there are two big questions there that have yet to be answered by science and that science can't answer. First of all, why are there any laws at all? Where do these laws come from? If you think about this universe, it's crazy the way that it acts. Everything behaves perfectly well. The universe behaves so well, we can use all sorts of mathematical equations to predict what's going to happen next. You know, the law of gravity doesn't take the day off every so often. Electromagnetics doesn't fail to work every once in a while. You know, scientists can explain what's going to happen because the laws of nature are reliable. Why are there any laws at all? Why is our universe so orderly, so structured? Why is it so ordered that we can describe it with these laws? And why is there anything for these laws to describe? The second question is, why is there anything at all? Why are there all these atoms and molecules in our universe? Where did all these particles come from? Science can't explain that. Science is out to describe what's going on out there. There's no way in the world that science can explain our universe because science is out to describe it in terms of laws and it can't say where these laws came from. We make an idol out of science. We're trying to use it to explain away God, but actually what it does is it points us to the fact that we live in a universe that needed something greater than it to make it, something greater than this universe to explain it. And this universe is so well ordered, so well structured, that it must have been planned. Science gives us very good reason to believe in God. Let's take a little statement. Let's take a little statement that people will use, that people will say. They'll say, I'll only believe in something if science can prove it. I'll only believe in what can be scientifically proven to be true. Well, write that down in a bit of paper. When somebody says that to you, write it down in a little slip of paper. Only believe what science says is true. And then show it to them. And then ask them, well, where's your scientific proof for that? Where is your scientific proof that I should only believe in what science says to be true? Prove that scientifically. You see, it doesn't turn up in any scientific experiment. What do? Grab a group of scientists, put them in a test tube, boil them, see what colour they turn? There's no scientific experiment that shows that you should only believe in what science shows. It doesn't show up in any scientific theory. That's not what science does. Science is out there examining the world around us. It's not trying to come up with, you know, what are the only questions we should ask. And sometimes a fan of science, somebody who makes an idol out of science, will say, well, you know, look at the wonderful success that science has had in explaining this world and in creating engines. That's true. But just because you have a way of answering one type of question, just because you have a fantastic way of answering one type of question, doesn't mean that that's the only way to answer every question. You might have a mechanic who can explain everything about your car and explain it in perfect detail, and he knows everything about cars. But that doesn't mean that he's going to know everything about computers. It doesn't mean that he's going to know everything about electronics. It just means that he's very good at one particular type of question. Science is very good at one particular type of question. What's the world like? What's the physical world like? The world that we encounter, the world that we bump into, the world that we can measure. What's that world like? And can we predict what's going to happen next in it? And it's great at answering those questions and using the answers to make things. But that doesn't mean it can answer questions like, why are we here? It doesn't mean that it can answer questions like, is there a purpose to my life? It doesn't mean it can answer questions like, why is there anything at all? Or why is this universe so orderly? There are questions there that science can't answer. And if religion provides an answer, the scientists can't huff and say, well, you know, I'm not taking that answer seriously because it's not science. That's just throwing your teddy bear in the corner and refusing to play anymore. If somebody else has got a good answer to your question, it's no use to say, well, I don't recognise that answer because, you know, it's not what I do during my day job. And frankly, not every scientist, as a matter of fact, most scientists don't buy into this idea that science is the only way to answer important questions. Most scientists are well aware that there are many types of questions out there and many ways to answer them. If somebody says to you, I love you, if you are told that in years to come, and somebody walks up, you're going out with somebody and you're about to get married, and they say, I love you and I'm going to stay faithful to you and I'd like to marry you, don't say back to them, well, I will pay that statement the compliment of treating it like a scientific hypothesis. Let me take you to a psychologist. Let me do a statistical test. You know, you'll be dumped on the spot. If you want to know somebody's faithful to you, you get into a relationship with them and you work out what they're like and who they are. And you don't get that by following the methods of science. You don't do it that way. I don't know if you watch disaster movies. I don't know if you pay much attention to them, but in disaster movies, for example, movies like The Day After Tomorrow, you might have seen on television, or 2012, which is a particularly, you know, bizarre disaster movie, but a lot of fun that came out a year or so back. The world is usually faced with some terrible disaster, something, you know, in 2012, literally the whole world is on the verge of extinction, and then in The Day After Tomorrow, there's going to be an ice age, and the movie Jaws type of disaster movie. There's a shark and it's stalking the beaches of Amity and it's killing people. And in each of these films, a scientist plays the role of a prophet. A scientist realizes that there's something dangerous about to happen and they're the only person with an answer. In the film Earthquake, the towering inferno, there are architects who realise that the buildings aren't safe and they can't get people to listen to them. In the 90s film Volcano, there's a volcanologist running around telling everybody there's a volcano under LA. Only the scientist knows. Nobody will listen to her. In Independence Day, and in science fiction movies, it goes one stage further. The scientist is the saviour of the world. In Independence Day, which I seriously recommend that you watch, in Independence Day, Jeff Goldblum is the guy who works out how to download a virus onto the aliens' computers and shut all the alien spaceships down. The scientist is the saviour. And that taps into this belief that science will make the world into a better place. We've been told this for hundreds of years. Science will make the world a better place. Education will improve everybody's character. We will create a perfect world with science. We will create a perfect world with technology. There's a problem with that. You see, science does wonderful things, but science is run by human beings. Science is a human endeavour. It's a human project, something that we're up to, that we're doing. And frankly, we're nuts. Frankly, we do things that are crazy, that make no sense. In the early 60s, round about the time when Stanley Milgram was running some of these experiments at Stanford, President Kennedy in America sent ships around the island of Cuba because the Soviets were trying to put missiles there, atomic weapons, that could destroy American cities in a microsecond. Horrible weapons. Nuclear weapons have the possibility, had the very potential to wipe this planet out, and now we face ecological crisis. We face crisis of nuclear power, the generators that break down. We face all sorts of problems brought about because human beings just aren't responsible enough to handle the power that science gives us. Science can't change human nature. There's a flaw in us. And the very technology that gives us so much power to cure diseases also gives us the power to make terrible biological and chemical weapons. The Soviets, during the Cold War, ran programs to try and eradicate a disease called smallpox. And they succeeded. Why did they put so much effort into this? Because in their laboratories they were keeping smallpox so that they could use it as a weapon in the event of a war with America. Science gives us tremendous freedom, tremendous gifts, but it also brings dangers. Science can't cure human nature. And this is the terrible problem with science. If we make an idol out of it, the very success of science brings terrible dangers. If you want to be changed, if you want to fix the human condition, if you want to fix what's wrong with human beings, you're going to have to look somewhere else than science. You're going to have to look to something bigger than you, bigger than any human project. You're going to have to look at something bigger than any human invention, any human creation. You're going to have to look at somebody bigger than us, bigger than this universe. You're going to need to look to God. You're going to look at what God has done. The key is to remember, don't make an idol out of science. Now, don't neglect it. I'm a teacher. You know I'm an RE teacher. One thing that I always regret is that I didn't pay enough attention to the science at school. It's a tremendous subject. A lot of the mathematics that surround it seem daunting to people on the outside. The more I look at this, I realise that, you know, I wish I'd paid more attention to this. There's so much good there. There's so much excitement there. It's a wonderful subject. I wish we all took it much more seriously. But just because it's a very good thing doesn't make it a god. Just because it's a very good thing doesn't mean that it can replace God. And just because we have science doesn't mean that we can leave God out of our lives. Don't make an idol out of something that's good.